Virginia Voice presents part two of the Botticelli exhibit at the Muscarelli Museum of Art.
This is the audio description recording of the Botticelli exhibit at the Muscarelli Museum in Williamsburg, Virginia, adapted to read to Virginia Voice by Shirley Canifo Rader. I'm Katie Hennekins.
And I'm Thomas Cunningham.
And we will be your readers.
Next, we again have St. Augustine in his study. Now from 1490 to 1494. Medium tempera on panel, dimensions 16 inches by 11. Also at the Uffizi in Florence. St. Augustine in his study was probably executed for an Augustinian hermit of Santo Spirito, as shown by the fact that the saints wear both episcopal and hermit garments. As many of Botticelli's late works, the preaching of Savonarola inspires it. We will compare this with the first St. Augustine we discussed that was painted in 1480. Unlike the first St. Augustine in his study, painted 10 years earlier, the small devotional painting of St. Augustine is sitting, looking down the paper he is writing, placed at a simple desk behind a light-colored curtain trimmed with gold that is held back with a rod. This stresses the monastic life of the saint. The ceiling is vaulted and is divided into squares that have ornamented details within each square and laurel molding trim around the archway. The perspective geometric lines on the ceiling demonstrate Botticelli's careful calculations of visual space. The light from the left is on his face and robe. The small alcove is without books and his tools of learning. Except for the barrel-vaulted ceiling and arch trim, the back wall where there is a medallion relief of the Virgin and Child and the medallions of Roman emperors that decorate the outside walls, the space is sparse of any ornamentation. There are no colors except for the dull gray. The sight feels lonely, but contemplative. St. Augustine is trying to write something, but the scattered, crumpled pieces of paper on the floor in front of him tell us, the viewer, that he is struggling with his thoughts. The desk he is sitting at is not covered with a cloth, and all we see is the worn-out quill he is using and the paper he is writing on. His feet are resting on a ledge that may be part of the support for the desk. His robe is full, but not flowing as before. Under the red bishop's cloak, he's wearing the dark brown habit of an Augustinian hermit. St. Augustine's hood is hatched with gold, shiny threads, as is the fringe on his cloak. He has lost most of his hair, but has a ring of curls around the lower part of his head and on his beard, and is longer than before. A gold halo is placed over his head. The Augustinian hermit this painting was made for is from the Basilica di Santo Spirito, the Basilica of the Holy Spirit, a church in Florence, Italy. Usually referred to simply as Santo Spirito, it is located at the Oltranor Quarter, facing the square with the same name. Interior of the building is one of the preeminent examples of Renaissance architecture. Botticelli was a follower of Savonarola, and his style of painting was now without the light, line, and beauty that we witnessed before.
Continuing to see Botticelli's transformation under the influence of Savonarola, we come to our seventh work, The Adoration of the Magi, unfinished. Its date is 1500, tempera on wood panel. It is located in the Uffizi Gallery, Florence, Italy. Botticelli was approximately 55 years old when he painted this. The political and religious crisis of the 1490s clearly left its mark on his late work. He created fewer monumental works and devoted himself principally to producing devotional pictures and small altars. His themes were now almost exclusively religious ones, and in his style there was a decisive change to a hitherto unknown degree of soberness and strictness. In his compositions, he increasingly dispensed with lively decorations, concentrating instead on excessive structuring of the figures. It would be oversimplifying to ascribe this evident change to Botticelli's later work exclusively to the influence of Savonarola, as Vasari, his biographer, does. If he is to be believed, Botticelli was a keen follower of Savonarola and neglected his work to such an extent that he became impoverished. But quite the opposite must have been the case. He was reasonably well off, and he continued to work until after 1500, as is proven by existing works and documents. King Charles VIII of France marched his army into Italy in 1494 to reestablish French claims to the rule of the Kingdom of Naples and entwined himself with Florentine religion and politics. We will identify King Charles as the second principal in this painting, after the newborn Christ. Savonarola had entered Florence in 1490. At the time of the painting, in 1500, the people of the land were conditioned to worship Savonarola. This final adoration of the Magi, painted in 1500, lacks the attention to detail, the intensity and the passion of Botticelli of the past. The last adoration may be expressing the view of King Charles' mission during the terrible few years before his and Savonarola's missions failed. The coloring of the Virgin and Child, the landscape and sky were all added later. This painting is a large, wide scene in the countryside of Italy. The setting of huge rocks in the background is craggy, rough-hewn, ominously overbalanced, as if they were taken from living stones. The crowd in the middle and the foreground of the painting may symbolize as living stones making up the religious symbolism of the church. They are very artificially done. The symmetry of the worshippers in the painting is crowded toward the Holy Family, which is to the left of center. They are not well seen by the viewer. The Magi are practically indistinguishable. One Magi, denoted as number 2 in the accompanying print, is dressed in a blue cloak, kneeling closest to the Christ child and kissing his foot. The other two are slightly closer to the child. There are 4 or 5 persons kneeling around Christ, and another in one on the right, halfway down to his knees, removing his hat and bowing. 2 more are thrust forward on the left and right of the Holy Family, both with arms crossed in reverence. There are no crowns or gifts to be seen. They are nearly enveloped by the crowd pressing forward. Can this express the Savonarola view that the true king of all needs no crown? The people in the crowd are all clothed in long cloaks of dark, solemn black and bright, hot red, and some cool blue as converts to Christ's universal church, similar to the color cool blue of Charles' uniform, and with Mary in her usual cool blue robe. Hats differ throughout the crowd, maybe to show the entire world has converted. There is one of the kneeling groups of wise men to the right side, in the foreground, wearing a dark black cloak that may be wearing a Jewish prayer shawl over his shoulders. Does this foretell Savonarola's prophecy that everyone will be converted to the Christianity he espouses? Some suggest the 2 partially hidden figures in the crowd, to the left of Joseph, just outside the circle of wise men, are Savonarola himself. He wears a brown monkish coat, exhorting and pointing our Christ child to Lorenzo de' Medici the Magnificent, who had died in 1492. There is one figure distinguished from all the rest, but not with the Magi. He stands prominently, with his right foot bent slightly at the knee and wearing his sword on the side as a Donatello statue. In the right foreground, regarding Christ over and across the kneeling adorers, alone wearing distinctly modern, fashionable, aristocratic dress, holding a prominent sword, further marks him out. He stands still where others are pressing, gesturing, crowding, all filled with eagerness of ardent devotion, straining and yearning, expecting only the Holy Family themselves. More alone, yet among the crowd than they seem to be. The figure is wearing a short coat, men's tights, a soft French-style boot. His head is covered by a gold-bordered white cap decorated with black feathers, and is carrying a sword similar to the ones identified by record at his arrival in Florence. There is one riderless horse, from which the Charles figure nearby seems to have dismounted. it is attended by the only two other figures wearing modern men's short cloaks over hose. Can this unique standing figure be King Charles VIII? The Adoration of Christ by the Magi, a frequent subject in Florence, and one Botticelli had painted several times over the years, is shown here, but this particular work was never finished. Today it sits unheralded in the storerooms of the Uffizi Gallery, yet Botticelli's unfinished Adoration deserves appreciation not only for artistic qualities, but also as a remarkably poignant revelation of its times. Its subject, more contemporary than simply biblical story of the Magi, and its incompletion are closely linked to the grandiose, ultimately disappointing Italian missions of King Charles VIII, and are intertwined with Florentine religion and politics. Charles died in 1498 after accidentally striking his head on the lintel of a door. Savonarola was captured and arrested and ultimately executed for heresy on May 23, 1498. Whatever the circumstances of its original commission, begun in hope, carried out with commitment, intellect, skill, it was abandoned in disappointment, and perhaps because of commission withdrawals. Botticelli's unfinished Adoration reveals both King Charles and Savonarola's disillusions and their unfinished missions.
And now we move on to the Judgment of Paris. 1485 to 1488, tempera on wood panel, Venice, Dudorio Cini Foundation, Galleria di Palazzo Cini. Mythology and Botticelli. Remember, mythology is a story and may have many variations. Among Botticelli's best-known works are The Birth of Venus, Venus and Mars, and Primavera. But before we discover those paintings, I've chosen to show you Botticelli's version of the Judgment of Paris. Here he's chosen to present all of the goddesses as fully clothed. This is one of the few paintings of this myth to exclude nudity. This is one of the very few versions in which all three goddesses are fully clothed. I find it fascinating that Botticelli has decided to juxtapose a multitude of common, ordinary objects and vignettes within his depiction of what would seem to be a supernatural event. This is a visual mirroring of the symbolic disconnect of the situation in which three immortal goddesses wait on a mortal man to judge their beauty. That the viewer is hardly aware of the incongruence between the ordinary and the extraordinary is a testament to the skill and talent of the artist. The Judgment of Paris is a story from Greek mythology, which was one of the events that led up to the Trojan War and, in slightly later versions of the story, the foundation of Rome. It is recounted that Zeus held a banquet in celebration of the marriage of Peleus and Thetis, parents of Achilles. Eris, goddess of discord, was not invited, for it was believed she would make the party unpleasant for everyone. Angered by this snub, Eris arrived at the celebration with a golden apple from the garden of the Hesperides, which she threw into the proceedings as a prize of beauty. On the apple was the inscription, "For the fairest one." Three goddesses claimed the apple, Hera, Athena, and Aphrodite. They asked Zeus to judge which of them was fairest, and eventually he, reluctant to favor any claim himself, declared that Paris, a Trojan mortal, would judge their cases, for he had recently shown his exemplary fairness in a contest in which Ares, in bull form, had bested Paris's own prize bull, and the shepherd prince had unhesitatingly awarded the prize to the god. Thus it happened that, with Hermes as their guide, the three candidates bathed in the spring of Ida, and then confronted Paris on Mount Ida, in the climactic moment that is the crux of the tale. After failing to judge their beauty with their clothing on, the three goddesses stripped nude to convince Paris of their worthiness. While Paris inspected them, each attempted with her powers to bribe him. Hera offered to make him king of Europe and Asia. Athena, or Minerva to the Romans, offered wisdom and skill in war. And Aphrodite, or Venus to the Romans, who had the charities enhance her charms with flowers and song, offered the world's most beautiful woman. This was Helen of Sparta, wife of the Greek king Menelaus. Paris accepted Aphrodite's gift and awarded the apple to her, receiving Helen as well as the enmity of the Greeks, and especially that of Hera. The Greeks' expedition to retrieve Helen from Paris and Troy is the mythological basis of the Trojan War. This story of the judgment of Paris naturally offered artists the opportunity to depict a sort of beauty contest between three beautiful female nudes. But the myth, at least since Euripides, rather concerns a choice among the gifts that each goddess embodies. The bribery involved is ironic and a late ingredient. Hera is indeed the most beautiful, not Aphrodite. However, Hera was the goddess of the marital order and of cuckolded wives, amongst other things. She was often portrayed as the shrewish, jealous wife of Zeus, who himself often escaped from her controlling ways by cheating on her with other women, mortal and immortal. She had fidelity and chastity in mind and was careful to be modest when Paris was inspecting her. Aphrodite, dressed in a white gown, though not as objectively beautiful as Hera, was the goddess of sexuality, and was effortlessly more sexual and charming before him. Thus, she was able to sway Paris into judging her the fairest. Athena's beauty is rarely commented on in the myths, perhaps because Greeks held her up as an asexual being, being able to overcome her womanly weakness to both become wise and talented in war, both considered male domains by the Greeks of the time. Her rage at losing makes her join the Greeks in the battle against Paris's Trojans, a key event in the turning point of the war. In this judgment of Paris, we are taken to a scene in the countryside. Calm water is in the background, as well as a city that is probably Rome. A small boat is on the water, one docked. In the middle ground, we are on land, and there are some animals, a few plants and a tree next to where Paris is sitting, tending his sheep and goats and cows, holding the apple. There's one dog sitting by his side and another wagging his tail, standing between the line of beautiful women in Paris. The women all clothed in long dresses with scarves around them and sandals on their feet. Paris is telling them that they were all beautiful, so they'll have to take off their garments so that he might judge them. Well, we all know what happens next. The start of the Trojan War. Why Botticelli depicted this myth is not known. Was it because Savonarola, or was it because his patron wanted it as a sofa piece rather than a bedroom? Allegoric paintings. The 1480s were Botticelli's most productive years. While he was one of the most desirable painters in Florence even before he left for Rome, by the time he returned, after the large project working on the frescoes for the Pope, his reputation was firmly established. He gained commissions from the families in high society, who increasingly chose classical themes for the luxurious decoration of their townhouses. In this period, Botticelli created a large-format mythological and allegorical painting, Primavera, Pallas Athena and the Centaur, Venus and Mars, Birth of Venus, and these are only some of his best-known works. These paintings constitute an unusually homogeneous group, not only in pictorial content, but also in stylistic expression. Despite research by art historians that has continued for over a century, they are still a mystery. This tour will take you to Athena and the Centaur, Venus, the precursor for Birth of Venus itself, and conclude with Primavera. The difficulty in deciphering them lies in the fact that there are no known predecessors, nor can their pictorial programs be conclusively derived from written sources. Rather, they are a blending of classical and modern sources. These paintings were not originally intended to be seen by a larger audience, but were hung in private rooms, tailored precisely to the requirements of the client and reflecting their particular interests in the classical body of thought. The study of antiquity was particularly encouraged in the humanist circle associated with the Medicis, and Botticelli's patrons also belonged to it.
That's the end of part two of our tour. Stay tuned next week for the conclusion.